I'm working on the title of my book. I think it's going to be The Unorthodox Climb to the Top of the Basketball World by Jerry Ice Reynolds.
I like it.
Because my journey was so different from anyone else's journey as a basketball player and somebody who got drafted 22nd overall.
Then you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off and there's number 23. And of course, Johnny goes nuts.
We're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you made the pass. Yes. Christian, can you catch the ball? Yes.
All the stars were aligned and all the muscles fired at the right time. And I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 79. Thanks for joining me. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Jerry Reynolds to the show. We cover his life in basketball. Jerry has a unique story that I'm sure you'll really enjoy learning more about. Towards the end of the episode, I'll share another great podcast review. You can add yours by visiting inallairness.com/review. Show notes for this episode, including links to numerous topics covered, are at inallairness.com/79. Now, onto the show. My guest today was New York City Player of the Year, and his name is littered throughout the record books of Louisiana State University. He played 8 seasons in the NBA. Jerry Reynolds, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here, man. I've been hyped about doing this video ever since the Skype. You know, I'm new to Skype and all of that. I love Australia, and I've been a couple of times, and you guys showed me great hospitality and great love. So looking forward to getting this done right now.
Fantastic. And it's good to be able to see you on the camera whilst we're chatting as well. Don't often have the chance to speak face-to-face, so it's excellent to see you today. I found out that you were born in Brooklyn, and as a youngster, what sports were you interested in, and when did basketball become the sport that you chose to pursue?
Well, initially, growing up, baseball was my first love. I played that from, from, say, 8, 9, 10, and 11 is when I started to play basketball. That's when baseball became boring. Once I got a taste of running up and down the court and scoring and rebounding and just the constant motion of basketball was very gratifying for me.
What sort of height were you when you were a youngster? Did you stand out above the crowd already at that age, or was it later in the teenage years that you started to really grow?
No, I was actually pretty normal height for a kid that age, 11, 12. I was pretty normal along with the other kids my age. I really didn't hit my growth spurt until I was 14, until I got to high school.
Now, I'd just love to quickly confirm the origins of your nickname. It's Ice, a very cool nickname, no pun intended. What led to you being dubbed Ice?
Well, it's a funny story how that started, and this is when I was 11. So at lunchtime during sixth grade, we would go out to the playground and play basketball. I didn't know what I was doing at this time. I was just a kid with the other kids just outside wasting some time playing basketball. I wasn't in love with the game yet. I was just kind of toying around with it. I guess they said that I used to take these weird shots and make weird shots. And I didn't even know who Iceman Gervin was at the time. And these kids started saying, you should play like Iceman. So I just kind of blew it off at the time. As I got older, I moved from that neighborhood. And when I moved to the next neighborhood, when kids came up to me and asked me what my name was, I don't know what made me say Ice, but I did. And it kind of grew into me being compared to George Gervin, the Iceman, the original Iceman.
That's great.
Who I became to be a great fan of as I grew older.
Do you know when it actually was that you first met George Gervin?
And of course, you know, he was my idol. Once I got to the NBA at age 22, I had known about him and became a big fan of his. And that's when I noticed the similarities in us. He was 6'8", I was 6'8". He was tall and skinny, I was tall and skinny. The only difference was that he was a great shooter, and I wasn't a great shooter. I could do all of the other things, pass, dunk on people, you know, run the offense, run the fast break. but I wasn't a great shooter. So that was really the difference. But I could finger roll and, you know, I could do all of the stuff that he did going to the basket. But that jump shot was something that I never really mastered in the NBA.
That's fantastic to hear this sort of stuff. Now, in 1980-81, you were named New York City's Player of the Year. And in one of the articles I read whilst I was researching your career today, you averaged an amazing 28 points, 18 rebounds, 7 assists, and 4 blocks a game. Now, looking back to those high school days, Jerry, what stands out most about the development of your game throughout your high school career?
Well, for me, what happened was there's an organization that was, it's no longer in existence now, but it was called Brooklyn USA.
Okay.
It was not too far from my house where I moved to that next neighborhood. The guy that I met in the high school, he used to play with me in those lunch times. He actually, I guess, thought I was pretty good, and he was already on a team. He asked me to go with him to Brooklyn, USA. And I was like, sure, you know. And we were about 12 at the time. So what happened was that my high school coach turned out to be one of the coaches for Brooklyn, USA. I grew up in that organization, and then my coach happened to be from that organization. So I had great coaching as a youngster. That is really how I made it to the NBA, because I had such a great foundation as a young player that once I got to high school, it really took another turn, because we did all of that stuff that we did in college, I did in high school. It wasn't easy. I wasn't surprised by it. The only thing I was surprised about in college was the physicality of it that I had to get used to.
Just before we move on to your college career, where you also had some great coaches I assume would have been influenced by as well, in the Philadelphia Daily News in June of 81, there was an article which is titled Top 50 Basketball Recruits, and it had this to say about you. Quote, anyone who watched him play against Ben Franklin in the Big City Classic, and that was in March of that year, at Palestra, knows why they call him Ice, end quote. So that game was a matchup between yourself and the Philly Public League champions, and you guys won the game 86-75, and you had 32 points, and it says that it was all on field goals. So is that a performance that you can particularly recall?
Well, let's start in my high school years, and then I'll get to that game.
Yeah, please do.
Because a lot happened before that game. I was actually cut from the high school team my freshman year.
Oh, okay, wow.
And I was very upset with that, because the guy that brought me, we were the same grade. And so when we went to the high school, Alexander Hamilton High School, together as freshmen, he was allowed to play varsity and I wasn't. So I was kind of mad about that. I had a real attitude about what I was going to do the next year when I came back. You know, I was going to try to be better. The coach said I was too skinny, and that's why he didn't allow me to play on the varsity that year. I was real upset about that, because I'm still skinny today. So that kind of ticked me off. But when I came back as a sophomore, I wasn't a starter. You know, the coach had enough confidence in me to start letting me play my sophomore year. And we were a pretty good team. We went to the playoffs and everything. And then, you know, my junior year, I got to start that year and had a better year my junior year. When I became a senior, that's when I excelled, I guess, as far as my overall game, in every aspect except shooting. I was a terrible free throw shooter, and I was a terrible outside shooter, period. But everything else, I was pretty good at. You know, I could dribble, I could rebound, I blocked shots, I stole, I led every team I played on in steals. I just had a knack for playing the passing lanes and pretending that I wasn't really playing defense when I actually was, and waiting for you to make a lazy pass to the guy I was guarding, and then I would jump into the passing lane, make a steal, go down and get a dunk. I would get like 3 or 4 of those a game. When I went to Philadelphia, the week before that game was the New York City Championship, which was in New York City. We played against a school called Andrew Jackson High School, who was loaded with talent as well as we were. We beat them, and then we went on to Philly to play the next weekend. I was really playing well at the time in the championship game. I scored like 28 points in the championship game, and we won that game. That's how we got to play in the Big City Classic, in the first Big City Classic, which was in Philadelphia, where they were the city champions of Philadelphia. We were the city champions of New York. And that was the first actually nationally televised high school game in the history of high school basketball, basically.
What was the New York City scene like at that stage? You're improving your skills as the years go on throughout high school. What other players do you remember going up against that you'd end up having future meetings with as the years would progress?
The major one that I have to mention is a player by the name of Chris Mullin.
Okay, yep, Chris, yeah.
You might have heard of him. He's a Hall of Famer.
I have indeed. Yeah, he's St. John's coach at the moment.
After we beat Ben Franklin that weekend, the following weekend was the state tournament, which after you win the city, you go to the state. And if you win there, then you are state champion. And that's how the high school system goes in the states here. You win your city, then you go on to the state where you play against, you know, people that won their cities as well.
Mm-hmm.
We faced another Brooklyn team in the state tournament because Chris Mullin is from Brooklyn as well. And we grew up playing in the summer times on all-star teams, traveling teams. So we were familiar with each other before we played in that game. And but in Ben Franklin, in that televised game, I think it maybe been the second quarter, where I went on a fast break and I went up for a layup and the guy jumped in front of me and took a charge. And when I landed on my shooting hand, but with my whole weight of my body on my wrist. And it really felt like it was broke. That was the point where in my high school career, my coach, because I really wanted to come out of that game, to be honest with you. My hand was hurting so bad. It was throbbing so bad. So they called the block on that play. Coach called timeout after I went down. And during that timeout, the coach goes, "Jerry, we need you." And, you know, I told him how much my hand was hurting. "Coach, I can't go anymore. You know, that's it. My hand is just killing me. Can't play." And he looked me in the face and he said, "Jerry, we need you." And I don't know what came over me at that point, but it was something that turned me into a man that day. I went out and I finished the game and I had a great game. As you said, I was the MVP of the game. I scored 32 points. To this day, I don't know how I did that, because after the game, when we were going home on the bus, my hand swole up like a boxing glove.
Hmm.
So that was really disheartening, because I knew that would affect the state tournament, which was following weekend, to play against Chris Mullin and his powerful Zaverian team. So that game was a special game that day. And to have Hall of Fame Billy Cunningham was the announcer.
Okay.
Of that game. And he was the commentator. So to have him say all of the nice things that he said about me when I was playing that game, you know, a lot of my friends and family, when I got home, told me all of the nice things that he said and blah, blah, blah. And I was pretty excited and pretty pumped about that. And, you know, to get the win as well and to be on TV and to be able to say hi, Mom, was a great moment for an 18-year-old kid from Brooklyn that everybody said was too skinny to play on a high level.
Well, you certainly proved a lot of people wrong there, because you went on to have a 8-year career in the NBA and excelled in college, which we'll get to in just a moment. Do you have many of your old games on videotape or DVD these days, or not a lot?
You know, you would think that in this age of video, where everything is on video, that I would have a library of games on DVD at least. And I don't. That's why when you sent me that clip of that game in college, I had been asking people for that DVD of that game, because that's my best college game against North Carolina and Michael Jordan. And I've never seen the highlights of that game, you know. And it's really mind blowing. But I was really excited when I put it online. So many people commented about it, because I guess a lot of people saw that game and let me know, you know, how much they enjoyed watching that game and how much they admired the fact that I played Michael Jordan head to head. You know, just came up short on the win, but we both scored the same amount and we were selected as the Chevrolet Players of the Game.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And for what it's worth, the game DVD should turn up to your place any day. I mailed it a week or so ago, so hopefully it'll turn up the full game and you'll be able to relive it so many years down the track. So I hope you certainly enjoy that, watching it when it arrives. Now, when you left Alexander Hamilton, you ended up playing for Louisiana State University, but the circumstances behind you joining LSU are somewhat unique. From what I've read, you initially signed to play with Wisconsin, and then a series of events led you to playing with the Tigers. Do you mind just talking a little bit about what led you to Louisiana?
I signed to go to University of Wisconsin, and the funny story is about this Wisconsin deal that I got into out of high school was when I went home to tell people that I signed to go to college at Wisconsin. When I first mentioned the word Wisconsin, they were like, "What is that? What is Wisconsin? Like, what is that?" I was like, "It's a state. It's a school. It's, you know, it's in the Big Ten. It's a big time basketball program." But at the time, Wisconsin was in the basement. They were in last place in the Big Ten, and they weren't doing well at all. But the coach had a great recruiting season with myself and about three other guys that actually ended up playing in the NBA. And we were all coming in to be freshmen at the same time. So when I was in Wisconsin, I had went there after I got out of high school. I didn't finish high school well academically, so I had to sit out what would have been my freshman year at Wisconsin,
right,
to get my grades right. But that would have been my freshman year, but I had to sit that out. So while I'm sitting out that year, I'm in Wisconsin going to school. So I'm going to the games, watching the team play and everything, and you know, just staying in shape, going to school, doing what I had to do. So after the season ends, the coach that recruited me by the name of Bill Cofield, he gets fired after the season. So that threw a wrench in my plans to go to Wisconsin. And the reason that I chose Wisconsin was that Coach Cofield was going to allow me to play point guard.
Okay. Mm.
And he was the only person that saw that in me, that mentioned it and, you know, let me know that he thought that I could be a great point guard. So that was one of the major reasons that I ended up going to Wisconsin, signing to go to Wisconsin. We had a guy, he also recruited a guy out of Chicago by the name of Corey Blackwell, who was a 6'7 forward, a guy by the name of Brad Sellers, who eventually transferred to Ohio State, who went to the NBA. Corey got drafted to the NBA, and a guy by the name of Scott Roth, who was also drafted to the NBA, played a couple of years. So we had four with myself being NBA players on that Wisconsin team coming in.
Yeah.
So it kind of fell apart. Corey and Scott Roth stayed. Brad left to Ohio State, and I left and went to Louisiana State. So the reason I got to LSU was because I had a good friend who was a part of Brooklyn USA, that great organization that built my foundation as a basketball player in Brooklyn, a guy by the name of Lester Roberts, who was one of the founders of Brooklyn USA. He happened to be in Louisiana, in Baton Rouge, and being a good friend of Dale Brown, who was the head coach at LSU. I guess he heard my situation fell through in Wisconsin, and I guess he talked to Dale Brown about me without my knowledge, and I guess he convinced Dale Brown to at least meet me and have me come in for a visit. So I got a call from Lester Roberts, God bless him, because he has passed on many years ago, about 10 years ago. And he called me and said, "Jerry, you know, I got a situation down here at LSU I think you should look at. You know, I heard what happened to you there at Wisconsin, but I got a situation that might fit you." So I said, "Okay, you know, I trust you." You know, he was a guy I trusted. I didn't even hesitate to take that visit and go down to Baton Rouge. You know, everything was just the way it was supposed to be. You know, they showed me a lot of love there in Baton Rouge. He was there. He lived there. So he was kind of like my guardian, like my dad living there. And so it just kind of was a win-win situation for me. The basketball side, I didn't even really worry about. I knew the SEC was a strong conference at the time. So I knew I wasn't going to be lacking exposure which I really wanted to play on television. You know, that was one of the reasons I picked the Big Ten, because I know they had a lot of national exposure. And once I went to LSU and I saw their schedule and and who they play and all of that, and the coach didn't really know me. LSU was one of the few schools that didn't recruit me out of high school.
Right.
You know, I got letters from almost every school around the country, but LSU wasn't one of them. So we had to start anew, as you might say, with our relationship. And everything was good. It worked out. That's my story about Wisconsin going right into LSU.
I appreciate you opening up and discussing what happened there. Now, in your first season with LSU, the team went 19-13, and you were on the brink of the selection for the NCAA tournament. However, ended up taking part in the NIT, so you were overlooked for that bid in the main tourney. However, you did score 14 points in what I read was a pretty tough first round overtime loss to the University of New Orleans in Baton Rouge. How would you describe that finish to your freshman season? And I guess it was classed your freshman season, even though you set out that year at Wisconsin?
That was my freshman year in college. I was happy with the way I played as a freshman. You know, coming in and being selected to the SEC All-Freshman team, just missing being freshman of the year in the conference that year. I think Kenny Walker was the guy that won that award. A future NBA player.
Mm.
The funny thing about the University of New Orleans is that same guy that brought me to Brooklyn, USA, played for University of New Orleans.
All right.
That's one of my childhood friends, Eugene Beadle Washington. We go back since we were 11, 12 years old, and he winded up going to the University of New Orleans. You know, we were only an hour away from each other, so we used to actually drive up and down the highway to go and see him over in New Orleans. So to lose to two of my good friends, I had another good friend that played on that team from Brooklyn as well. You know, it wasn't so bad, even though I would have liked to beat them and move on. But we finished that year with a loss in the NIT. But I was happy that we did go to a national tournament my freshman year. I averaged 10 points and about 6 rebounds a game that year. So
I did note as well that you scored in double figures in 11 of the last 12 games that you played as a freshman, from what I've read too. So you're really starting to get the scoring column into gear there as well. When we talk about your sophomore season at LSU, you made it to the first round of the NCAA tournament. The team had a similar record. I think it was about 18-11. You led the team in scoring in that season at 14.2 points a game, and rebounding as well, 8.2 a game. So that was some great stats there. And that season, the legendary Tex Winter joined your team as an assistant coach to Dale Brown, if I'm not mistaken. You've already discussed some of the great coaching you had throughout your high school years. What was it like to have two great coaches like Dale Brown and Tex Winter to help tune your game throughout college, Jerry?
Well, Dale Brown was a different kind of coach.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't the best X and O's kind of coach, but he was a great motivator. He got you to play hard,
mm-hmm,
and stuff like that, but he wasn't a good teacher of the game. As far as I'm concerned. But when Tex came in, you mentioned Tex Winter, who I love, has been a great influence on my basketball journey ever since he came into the program my sophomore year. Now, he was a guy who knew the game in and out, backwards and frontwards. He was just a basketball junkie. He really came in with some simple but vital stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And he added that to the program. And I really think that it had a lot to do with my successful year that year because he made the game simple. He talked to you in terms of just simplicity of basketball. He was just great with his work with us.
That's good to hear as well, because obviously he'd, aside from the great things he achieved prior to that throughout his coaching career, he may be best well known as his time working with the Chicago Bulls, I guess, some years later as well. Now, we mentioned it briefly a moment ago. In January of 1984, you traveled to Chapel Hill to play the North Carolina Tar Heels. Prior to our chat today, I rewatched the game in full, and you had an outstanding performance, as we were talking about a moment ago. 29 points and 10 rebounds, and the game was dominated by spectacular plays from yourself and Michael Jordan. It was a much closer game than the scoreline suggested. I think it was 90-79 in the end.
Right.
Do you mind just describing the experience of playing in a nationally televised game? It was on NBC, and personally having such a stellar performance in front of some very diehard fans at Chapel Hill.
The first thing I remember about that particular game, because we played them each of my 3 years at LSU, we played them every year. And the first time we played them was in my backyard in the Meadowlands in New Jersey, which is right across the bridge from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that was on a neutral site. It was neither a home game for neither one of us, but it was in a great big arena. I can remember going to the arena on the bus my freshman year. And I used to always like try to vision the game, you know, in my mind on the way to the game. So I did that my freshman year, and it worked out pretty good. I had a good game that game. So my second year, when we were going to Chapel Hill, the day early, I guess we went to practice that day, and I saw people camped outside of the arena with tents and sleeping bags, and it was so many people around. It was just amazing to see. So I did the same thing on the way to the game. I just kind of envisioned myself playing well, just playing my game and doing what I knew I was capable of doing. So we get there and the game starts and their fans are going crazy. And it's a loud, hostile arena. And to be honest with you, that hyped me and gave me more energy to play well. I love the lights of the cameras, and I would see the trucks outside with CBS on it. And, you know, that used to just like, wow, you know, this is going to be on TV. My family are going to see it. My friends are going to see it. Millions of people are going to see it. So I was just excited to play. And when I played well, it felt really good to be on a national stage after the game, to hear some of the things that the announcers were saying about me was pretty gratifying.
It's great to hear you relive it. Now, prior to actually seeing the highlights again of the game, did you remember a majority of those moves that you were doing in that game? You had some incredible dunks, a couple of alley-oop dunks, just some massive, massive plays. Do you remember making a lot of those, or when you saw them again, was it like watching it the first time?
Well, I didn't really remember a lot of the plays that had happened, but the one dunk that I did remember was a rebound dunk, where, you know, I kind of came over like three or four people and dunked the ball over a few people. And that one I do remember. I did remember that one more than the other. But when I saw the highlights, I was really impressed with myself. I was like, wow, I made some pretty good moves in that game. I even hit one jump shot.
And you've got video proof.
Yeah.
I think at the time, North Carolina was 17-0 after the win, and you guys, you were 12-5 after the game. So put up a great fight there, and it was only in the last few minutes of the game where the scores got a little bit out of hand.
Yeah, a guy by the name of Jordan took over a little bit.
He did. I think he only had like 6 points or something in the first half, and then he took over in the second half. But
yeah,
it's some incredible highlights. And for what it's worth, in the show notes to this episode, I'll include links to the video from my YouTube channel. Just some incredible highlights, definitely worth taking a look at. Now, to round out that junior campaign, you led the team in assists with, I think, 3.6 a game. You made it to the NCAA tournament, and you'd meet the Dayton Flyers in the first round, and they were led by a former guest and friend of my podcast, Roosevelt Chapman.
Oh, you had Rosie on?
Yeah, I had him on the show on episode 48. He's a great guy. You led LSU in that game. I think you had 15 points, 13 boards, and 4 assists based on my little notes here, but fell just short, 74-66. Velvet, as Roosevelt's known, had 29 points and 8 rebounds. Now, you guys actually had history, I believe, dating back to the New York public school playoffs. So do you mind just talking maybe about that first appearance in the NCAA tournament, and then any particular memories you might have of playing against Roosevelt?
Yeah, like you said, Rosie and I go back to high school days. I played against Rosie. He went to Westinghouse High School in Brooklyn, and he was a monster player in high school. And so I knew what I was going up against when we got matched up together in the selection process. And so I was like, okay, we got to go up against a tough Brooklyn guy. And I knew what to expect from Rosie. But his team really played well that game, and we came up short, unfortunately. I just didn't, I guess, have enough firepower, or whether, I don't know if it was coaching or enough firepower, but Dayton played a great game. And like you said, Rosie had a world-class performance that game with 29 points.
Your stats were nothing to sneeze at either. They were very good too. Now, talking about your last season in college as a junior, your Tigers were the SEC champions, which is fantastic. You again made it to the NCAA tournament into the first round, and you were matched up against David Robinson, which I didn't actually know until just researching for our chat today. In that game, John Williams, who'd later go on to play in the NBA, John Hot Plate Williams, led LSU with 12 points. The Admiral had 18 points and 18 rebounds, from what I've read. That was your last game in college. Can you discuss perhaps what you remember from playing against David Robinson, and how did it feel to know that that would be likely your final game in college before turning pro?
Well, that kind of fast forward as to why I left school after my junior year. Mm-hmm. It wasn't because I was doing so great. You know, everything was climbing up the ladder like, you know, it would normally be for someone that was leaving school. You don't go to the NBA after you go, your scoring average and your rebounding average go down. Mm. You usually go to the NBA after you went from 14 points a game to 17, 18 points a game the next year. Then you say, well, you know, maybe I can go to the NBA and compete there. So that year, my junior year, and you mentioned John Williams, came to the Tigers. Now, John Williams was the top-rated high school player in America the year that he came out of high school. So that was 83. He was much heralded coming into LSU, and I was excited about it. He was from Los Angeles. I was from New York, and we got along great. We had a great relationship. But I don't think Dale Brown did a good job at meshing our talent. And I think that as a result of him not doing a good job meshing our talents, he kind of put me on the back burner and made John into our guy, the go-to guy as a freshman, which, you know, the kind of year that I had my sophomore year, you would have thought that, you know, he would have had to take a back seat, even though he was the player of the year in high school basketball.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's not how it went. And as a result, you know, everything from my minutes to my scoring to my rebounding to everything just kind of went down that year. Now, I had a decent year. I finished up averaging 11 points and I think 6 rebounds my junior year. But for me, I was not happy with the fact that my minutes and things went down instead of up. So that's what prompted me to enter the draft, not because I was this great player that was, you know, just doing gangbuster things in college basketball. So, you know, I'm sure we'll touch on that a little bit later. But the Admiral, let's talk about this guy. He's a Hall of Fame guy. He didn't have a real tough team, but that day they played really tough. He was a great player, but his team wasn't that great. So he was just carrying these guys pretty much and making it happen for his team. 18 points, 18 rebounds. He was just kind of unstoppable. He went on to be the Admiral David Robinson that, you know, wound up scoring 71 points in the NBA, you know, winning multiple championships. We didn't lose to a terrible team. So, you know, the fact that we lost to him makes it not hurt so bad. But I was pretty upset about that loss because their team wasn't better than our team.
I appreciate you opening up and the honesty there. I did read in many of the articles that I was looking at whilst putting together my notes for our chat today that you considered your sophomore season, and rightfully so, to be the pick of the bunch for your seasons, and it's a shame that you didn't get the opportunity perhaps to continue on that heading into your junior year, as you're suggesting there. One quick question before we chat about the NBA. Hall of Famer Pete Maravich, one of the greatest players to ever play the game, he played for 4 seasons with LSU and still holds numerous records, which probably will never be broken.
Right.
Did he ever visit your Tigers squad whilst you were in college?
No, I never got to meet Pete, unfortunately. But I did see pictures of him and all of the records that he had were around the arena that we played in. So I just used to be in awe of looking at the records that he set and that still stand today to tell you how awesome this guy was as a basketball player.
Yeah, incredible, no doubt. Now, just moving on to the 1985 NBA draft. You were selected number 22 overall by the Milwaukee Bucks, and this was the draft where the Knicks famously selected Patrick Ewing, number one overall. How were you preparing for the draft day, and did you have any idea about teams that were interested in you, and what sort of things were you doing leading up to that draft?
Well, let's talk about before I even decided to declare for the draft.
Okay, sure.
After we lost to David Robinson and Navy, I started to think, you know, what am I going to do here at LSU? And, you know, I was pretty upset with the fact that my stats had went down because I had just come off a great year, my sophomore year. And I was really looking forward to, you know, things getting better that year. So when it didn't, and after it was all over, I started to think, I actually took a drive around campus. LSU has this beautiful campus surrounded by these beautiful lakes. You know, I'm a loner when I get in my thoughts, and you know, having a mother who was hard of hearing, so I couldn't really call her and tell her about what I was thinking about. My dad wasn't really in my life, so he was out of the question about somebody I could call and talk to about these type of things. So I just kind of, to myself, without asking or talking to anyone else about it, I just came to the conclusion that I was better suited for the NBA than I was for college basketball. My game and my skill set, I thought I could give it a shot at least and put my name in the draft and see what happens. Not knowing anything, I didn't have an agent. You know, I just came to that conclusion.
Right.
That day when I went to sit at that lake by myself, and I just said, you know, I don't want my averages to go down from 11 down to say 8 or 9, you know, and my, that be my senior year and how I finish up. So I was really confident in my abilities. So I just, you know, eventually after I left that lake, I went to the coach's office. I went directly there and I went, knocked on his office door, and I said, "Coach, can I talk to you?" And like I said, I hadn't told anybody else what I was doing. Nobody else told me, you know, because most of the times when guys decide to go to the NBA, they talk to people about it and ask them how they feel or what you think I should do, blah, blah, blah.
Yep.
And I didn't do that. I'm working on the title of my book. I think it's going to be The Unorthodox Climb to the Top of the Basketball World by Jerry Ice Reynolds.
I like it.
Because my journey was so different from anyone else's journey as a basketball player, and somebody who got drafted 22nd overall. I go in Dale Brown's office. I say, "Coach, can I talk to you?" "Yeah, Jerry, come on in." I sit down in his office, and I'll never forget this day. And I say, "Coach, you know, first of all, I want to thank you for the opportunity, for letting me come to LSU and pursue an education and play basketball. You know, I really appreciate that. But I think at this time, I think I want to try my hand at the NBA. I think that my game is more suited for the NBA. I just think I want to go that route." And his response was the thing that I really never forget. He said, "Jerry, I'm going to just be honest with you, son. I think that you're not thinking straight." He said, "First of all, you're not a good shooter. Second of all, you're not strong enough." He said, "Those guys would just eat you alive in the NBA.
Wow.
My response back to him after he said that was, "You know, that's your opinion, coach, and everybody's entitled to one, but that's not going to change the way I feel. I think, you know, my game is more suited for that style of play. So, like I said, once again, thank you for the opportunity, but that's what I'm doing." And he said, "Well, to be honest with you, Marty Blake is a good friend of mine." Now, I didn't know who Marty Blake was at the time. He said, "Marty Blake is the director of scouting for the NBA. He said, I can call him right now, and he'll tell you exactly what I just told you."
Hmm.
So he calls him up. Boom, 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 boom. Calls him up, and I'm sitting across from him. He says, "Hi, Marty. This is Dale Brown at LSU. I got Jerry Reynolds sitting in my office, and he's thinking about putting his name in the NBA draft. He said, would you tell him that if he left now, he wouldn't make a red nickel in the NBA?" and then he hands me the phone.
Wow.
So basically, he just told the man what to say to me. And when he gave me the phone, the man actually said what Dale Brown just said to me. He was like, well, Jerry, I don't think you should come out and da-da-da and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, okay, Mr. Blake, thank you for your opinion. But, you know, my decision is made and thanks a lot. So I gave him the phone back. And he goes, thank you, Marty, blah, blah, blah. He hangs up the phone. And, you know, and so I was kind of ticked at that sitting there because, you know, I felt that my coach should have kind of been in my corner a little bit more with my decision. I just didn't feel like he really ever respected my game enough. The career I had at LSU was a career that was kind of held back a little bit because of the way that he coached. He wasn't a coach that lets you play your game, kind of, sort of, if you could understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had to go through situations where he told us we had to pass the ball 5 times before anybody could shoot. Whether you were open or not, you know, you had to like pass the ball 5 times. And then, you know, that was kind of guys on the team were really upset about that as a whole. We finished that way. That was the way, my relationship, with LSU ended, in the coach's office, that day.
Wow.
It was just on to the next page in my life, you know?
Yeah. I can't thank you enough just for opening up about that because that's quite confronting, I'd imagine, to say the least, to be able to hear that and then to try and have, the director of scouting back up his opinion and just tell you outright. It's a difficult thing to take it at your age, at that time. So yeah, thank you very much for sharing it. Just for some quick context, a summation of what you did at LSU. You're a member of the Tigers 1,000 point club. You're 7th all time with 194 career steals. And as you mentioned earlier on, you led the team in steals per game in each of your 3 seasons and left college averaging almost 12 points, almost 7 boards and more than 2 assists a game. So some really great numbers there, particularly given the previous scenarios you've been talking about. When it comes to draft day then, where were you on the draft day? Did you actually attend, given it was back in New York where you were born, or how did that sort of play itself out, Jerry?
That's funny because the day of the draft, I wasn't even paying attention to it.
Okay.
I was living in Los Angeles, California during that time because when I left LSU, I actually packed up my car and drove from Baton Rouge to Los Angeles because that's where my agent lived.
Oh, right.
When I finally selected an agent by the name of John Mackey, who's no longer with us, God bless him. He was an ex-football player for the Baltimore Colts who turned into an agent. Some friends of mine that were in Baton Rouge kind of knew him, and they put us in contact, and that's who my agent was going in. So I was in Los Angeles the day of the draft, and we didn't have cell phones back then. I actually got back to my apartment, and the first phone call I got was from who? Who would you think it was?
Was it Don Nelson?
Was from Dale Brown.
Oh, really? Wow. Okay, that's surprising. What did he have to say to you?
The phone rings and I'm home and it's Dale Brown. He goes, he was all excited. Oh, Jerry, I heard you went first round and you were 22nd pick overall and I knew you could do it. And da-da-da-da, and I'm holding the phone and I'm really kind of pissed at him because of, you know, what we had went through in Baton Rouge a few months earlier. So, you know, I was really gracious, and I said, thank you, coach. I really appreciate all you did for me, giving me the opportunity at LSU and so on and so forth. So that's how I found out that I was drafted first round in the NBA, 22nd overall. Coach Brown called me that day, and then I got a flood of other calls to follow that. But it's kind of ironic that he was the very first person that called me and told me he knew I could do it all the while.
Yeah, well, I wasn't expecting to hear that name.
Dale and I still have a great relationship today, though.
Well, that's good to hear. I wouldn't have expected that would have been the first call that you received, so that one caught me by surprise. Now, based on my facts here, and I'm not sure if I've got it right, but your first exhibition game with the Bucks was on October the 7th against Michael Jordan and the Chicago Bulls at Des Moines, Iowa. At least one of your first games. You won the game 129-114, and you had 10 points on 4 of 8 field goals. Do you remember that game, or is there any particular preseason game where you really thought, wow, now I'm at the highest level, and how you're progressing at that stage?
Well, you know, when you're on the court with Michael Jordan, you know that you're at the highest level. Even though that was just his second year in the NBA, he was already being touted as that guy. You know, he was playing great. He had a great rookie year, you know, so he was coming into his second year. You know, I was nervous going into my first exhibition game, but I had a bunch of great veteran guys at Milwaukee who were very helpful in helping the rookie along and teaching me the nuances of the NBA game, because it's very different from the college game. You don't know that as a young player going in. Before I got there, I thought I was in great shape. I thought I was a pretty good basketball player. But once you get there and you play against a guy like Terry Cummins, for instance,
yeah,
who was a great player, all-star. He was one of the top guys in Milwaukee. Sidney Moncrief, Terry Cummins were the two top guys from Milwaukee Bucks when I got there. And Terry Cummins was a 6'9", power forward, weighed about 250, just all muscle, just solid rock muscle. And, you know, he was a power forward. I'm a small forward. So the first day of training camp, when we were going to scrimmage, Don Nelson looks at me, and he's matching up everybody to play in the scrimmage. And he said, "Rook, you guard coming." And I kind of looked at him like, he ain't no small forward, you know, he's a power forward. And I guess, you know, he was testing me to see how I would respond to playing against this guy who was 50 pounds heavier than me and, you know, an inch taller than me, just to see how I would compete against him. I tell you what, he threw me around like a rag doll as much as he could, but I fought. And I think the coach realized that my slender frame wasn't to be taken for granted, that my heart, which people can't see from the outside, is pretty much why he drafted me. You know, my skill set, of course, but in order to play in the NBA, you have to have a big heart, because if you buckle under the situation that they put you in, they realize that you're not cut out for it, and they send you on your way.
I love to hear that story about Terry. He's a former guest on the show as well, so he was a great guy to chat to quite a few years ago. I had him on the show, so he had some great stories about his time in the NBA. Now, that Milwaukee squad that you joined, they'd won 5 straight Central Division titles and at least 50 games a year since 1981. So 2 of the previous 3 seasons, they were in the Eastern Conference Finals. You joined a stacked team that was one of the best teams in the East throughout the 1980s. In an April game at Chicago, you had perhaps what is your best performance as a rookie. You went 17 points, 10 assists, 4 steals, and 3 blocks. The Bulls would hold on for the win, but that was one of your best games as a rookie. I'm not sure if you actually remember the game or not. Is there a particular contest or a moment from that rookie season where you really thought that you belonged at this level?
Well, I kind of always thought that once I made it and I got drafted, that kind of let me know and gave me the confidence that I was supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So all I had to do at that point, once I got to training camp and started working out, is to compete and learn the NBA game. Because like I said, it's a whole different thing as far as the physicality of the game went. So once I got adjusted to that, then everything else was pretty much like a learning situation. I always had a confidence in my ability. But when I got that contract, that first contract where I put my signature and I was a legit NBA player, that's when my confidence level just kind of went up. It let me know that I had, my hard work had paid off, for one. It let me know that I had silenced my doubters. And it let me know that I had played against Michael before, so it wasn't like I was intimidated by Michael at all. Or any other NBA player for that matter. So, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, that whole Brooklyn USA foundation of, you know, the first teams that I ever played on, I was coached so well and was taught the game so well that, and I was taught to play hard back when I was a youngster. So, you know, as I grew, like I said, the game kind of, it didn't come easy, but I kind of knew what to expect.
Hmm.
I hope that answered that question.
Yeah, it does, for sure. In the 1986 playoffs, after beating the Nets 3-0 in a sweep and then you outlasted Philadelphia in seven games, you met the 1986 Boston Celtics in the Eastern Conference Finals. Of course, they went on to win the NBA Finals in 86, one of the greatest teams of all time, if not the best of all time. What do you recall about playing against Larry Bird, McHale, Parrish, and the rest of the Celtics as you took them on as a team in that 86 Eastern Conference Finals there, Jerry?
My rookie year was, that was the year that my first time to the Boston Garden, old, beat up, decrepit looking building. You know, it was just, it looked like it was something from the 50s, and it was, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing that in 1985, they were still playing in this old, dreary place, you know. So I remember getting off the team bus and all of these fans were out there at the Boston Garden. And so we go into the arena. We're walking to our locker room. So everybody, the team is walking together. It's very quiet in the arena because there are no fans in there. And we were going to practice, actually, to shoot around in the morning. And so it was very quiet. And what I remember is walking to the locker room and kind of lagging behind the team. And I heard a basketball bouncing off to the left where the arena floor was. As I heard the ball bouncing, I went to investigate and opened the door. I peeked my head inside, and there's just two people in there. There's Larry Bird and a guy rebounding for him. So I stood there and watched for about 5 minutes. And in those 5 minutes, Larry Bird was just going around the perimeter shooting jump shots. And for the whole 5 minutes, I stood there watching. The ball never hit the rim. It was just, all you heard was the net just going, whoosh, 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 whoosh. And I was like, I was standing there just amazed like a kid in the candy store, just like, wow, this guy is, I see why he's Larry Bird. They call him Larry Legend. He was just, his work ethic was just off the charts. I just watched him, and I never forgot that, you know. And I was just like, wow, this guy is really a workhorse, and he loves the game, and he loves getting better, and that's why he is what he is. That never left me. But those Celtics, you know, they had every position covered. They were a great team. Just when Larry wasn't doing much, you had McHale killing you, you had Parrish killing you, you had Dennis Johnson doing his thing. You had Danny Ainge doing his thing. I compare that starting five with any in the history of basketball. They were great champions, and they ended our seasons each time I went to the playoffs. We went to the playoffs every year. I was in Milwaukee, and it was the Celtics. They were the team to beat in the East.
Definitely. Thanks for sharing that great memory about Larry as well. That's fantastic to hear that. Now, in 1987, Don Nelson almost doubled your minutes per game, and then you further developed your skills as well on court. You again met the Celtics in the playoffs, as you just mentioned, but for the fourth time in the 1980s, they ended your season. Now, this was Don Nelson's last season as coach with Milwaukee. I think it was 11 seasons in all that he led the Bucks. What was it like to play for Don Nelson?
Nelly was great. I learned so much from him, even though he was hard to play for as a rookie. Tell you a little story about Don Nelson to show you what type of coach he was.
Mm-hmm.
We were in practice one day, and I don't know if this was my rookie year or not, one of the 3 years that I was there. It could have been my rookie year. We're scrimmaging at this time. They're going 5-on-5, and I happen to be one of the substitutes that was on the side with the coach. And so we're standing there, and they're going back and forth. And Sidney Moncrief comes down the court and gets fancy and throws it behind the back pass, and it sails out of bounds. And Don Nelson goes, "God damn it, rookie. You see why I don't like rookies? You see why rookies don't play for me?" He said, "Take off running. Come on, Rook." And I looked at him, but first, before I took off running, because I thought he was joking. Because, like I said, I wasn't on the court playing. I didn't make the turnover. I had nothing to do with it. I was just a rookie. And he looked at me. He said, "Take off, rookie. Take off running, Rook." I looked at him. And I started to jog in, and I just was waiting for him to say, "Nah, I'm just playing. I've been playing." He was serious. And I took off running, and I was running around the court while the scrimmage was going on. So I'm running my laps, and then I come around one time, and he said, "Hey, Rook, stay off the court," because, you know, I was kind of cutting the corner of the court a little bit, just, you know, not going right to the corner and turning like a robot and stuff like that. I was just kind of rounding off the court a little bit.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Hey, Rook, stay off the court before you hurt one of my players." Like, something wrong with this guy to myself. You know, I didn't let him see that my frustration was, you know, that I was frustrated and pissed off at the same time. But I just thought the man was crazy. But it was the way he was. And he told me after he drafted me, he took me somewhere. We went in a car ride. He said, "Jerry, you know, I think you're a great player. You remind me a lot of Paul Pressey, who was kind of built like me. He had long arms. He was a good defensive player. You know, he passed the ball well. He was like a point forward. He was actually the first point forward. And Nelson told me that that's why he drafted me, because I kind of reminded him of Paul Pressey."
Mm-hmm. That's great to hear.
So, okay, that was fine and everything. So we're in the car ride and he's driving and he goes, "You know what? I don't like rookies. I never like rookies. They don't play for me. They piss me off." So I'm sitting in the car with this guy and I want to ask, "Well, why'd you draft me then? If you don't play, if you're not going to play me, why would you draft me?" I didn't say that, but that was in my mind.
Yeah.
So he goes, he gives me the spiel about rookies. "I don't like rookies. Rookies don't play for me." So my response to him was, I said, "Coach, you know, that's cool and everything, but I'm going to be the first rookie to play for you." And I said, "Because I'm going to work my butt off in practice and I'm going to make you give me playing time." And that was my response to him telling me that he doesn't like rookies and blah, 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 blah. He was pretty much stuck to his word. And I didn't really play much in those 3 years. You're letting me know that I played more than I thought I played, because I thought that I really didn't play very much when I was in Milwaukee, and definitely not in the playoffs. Out of all the playoff 3 years in the playoffs, I probably played a total of 10 minutes. He was a man of his word, but he was a great coach, though, and he taught me a lot about the NBA game.
I love those stories, so thanks for sharing them. I appreciate them, and I'm sure our listener does as well. You've been very generous with your time. I don't want to hold you up for too much longer, but these are some great stories you're letting us know, so I appreciate this.
Take as much time as you want.
That's really generous. Thank you.
You're good.
In early October of 1988, the Bucks traded you to Seattle for a future second-round pick. Do you remember hearing news of the deal, and how did it feel to be leaving Milwaukee for the Supersonics?
Well, I didn't hear anything about deal, actually, until it happened.
Okay.
I didn't know I was going to be traded, but it happened that way, and it's just the nature of the business. It happened out of the blue, and it's funny because I think it was either the day before training camp started or 2 days before training camp started that the deal happened. So when that happens in the NBA, you have to pack up a bag with clothes, and then the team actually moves all your things to your next destination. I was actually kind of happy that I was going, because I didn't think I got much playing time.
Mm-hmm.
In Milwaukee, even though I learned a lot while I was there from Coach Nelson and the great veteran players that we had there. I learned how to be a professional. You know, I learned physicality of the NBA. You know, I learned how to not run into picks, which, coming out of college, that's what rookies do. You run into picks, and you hear coaches say, "You can't run into the damn pick. You can't. You got to get around the pick," and blah, blah, blah. So I learned all of that from the guys in Milwaukee. I was ready to move on and get an opportunity to play, basically, some more. And when I got to Seattle, another playoff team, they had a good team, went to a team with that was led by Xavier McDaniel and Dale Ellis, who were their two top guys when I went to Seattle. And both of those guys kind of played the same position I did, you know, small forward, big guard. So I knew I wasn't going to go in there and start or anything like that. So my focus was to go there and just earn some playing time, you know, try to get into the rotation. With me being a four-year veteran at that time, I was going to go into my fourth year.
Mm-hmm.
I was ready, you know. I was ready to hit the floor running and compete for some playing time.
It's great to hear this recap of what you experienced as you went from team to team. Now, you played 60 games with the Sonics and you had a season high of 25 points versus the Jazz in November of 88. Did you enjoy playing in the Western Conference, even though that was something you only did once in your career?
I did. I think the Western Conference was less physical as the Eastern Conference. I think they ran more. They did the up and down game more. You had the Showtime Lakers out there who couldn't wait to get on the fast break, you know, and run you. The funny story about Seattle is when I get there, and like I said, it was right before training camp starts, so I didn't miss any time. I got to start with them right from the start, which I was really, really appreciative of. So when I got there, everything was going good, and Bernie Bickerstaff was the coach.
Mm-hmm.
Nice guy, pretty good coach. You know, the team was stacked with veterans and a few young players. Nate McMillan, Michael Cage, Derek McKee, Sadale Threet, Alton Lister. We had a pretty good team. Like I said, it was a playoff team. Let's go to the preseason. You play 7-8 preseason games, and I had a great preseason. I actually led the team. I don't know if you got any research on this. I led the team in scoring, coming off the bench, and the newspaper was saying that I was missed a point a minute because I averaged 20 points a game and 20 minutes a game.
No, I didn't come across that. That's great.
For the whole preseason. So 8 games, I came off the bench and scored over 20 points a game. And, you know, I did my same steals and, you know, being active, doing other things. I've never been just a scorer. So I always got steals. I always got rebounds, got a few blocks. So I was really confident going into the season that I would be in the rotation at Seattle. I was really excited about my preseason, you know, 20 points, 20 minutes, not starting. And, you know, so I felt I was going to be a part of that rotation, at least the sixth or seventh man off the bench.
Mm-hmm.
The season starts and the first game, I don't play at all. Second game, I don't play at all. Third game, I don't play at all. I'm really getting frustrated because I worked my butt off in training camp and my confidence was good. You know, the players were receptive of the work that I put in and my effort. So about the fifth game came around and we're playing in Denver. I'll never forget. After the game, I didn't play. So I wanted to talk to the coach after the game and ask, you know, what's going on. I said, Bernie, you know, can I talk to you? And he said, sure. What's up, Jerry? And I said, well, coach, I just want to know why I'm not playing. You know, I had a great preseason and I felt good about the season and going in and, you know, getting in the rotation. And, you know, his response to me was, Jerry, you're not working hard in practice. You're not working hard enough in practice. And that really was a slap in the face to me because that's where my head was. You know, that's what type of player I am. I used to go to practice and love practice. I'm not the type of player that didn't like practice. I wasn't the Allen Iverson, like, practice. I love practice.
Yeah.
Because that was my opportunity to let the starters know that I'm just as good as you. I should be playing as well as you, maybe not as much as you, but I should be getting some playing time. And they knew that. So when he told me that I wasn't working hard enough to practice, it was really like a slap in the face to me. And to be honest with you, I really wanted to jump on him and choke him. But I thought better than that. And I just said, you know, okay, coach. And, you know, if that's what it is, then I'll work harder in practice, you know. But I don't agree with you, though. But because I was a veteran at the time. And, you know, you're man to man at the situation. You know, I wasn't a kid anymore. And, you know, I just wanted to know why I wasn't playing. So that was his answer. And I really wasn't happy with that answer because I know it wasn't true.
No, well, you seem to be obviously putting in the effort there and you just wanted to get a chance to show on the court what you could do in a game itself. No, so it's understandable. Moving away from Seattle, I think it was in June of 89, the Orlando Magic picked you in the NBA expansion draft. What do you remember about becoming an original member of the Orlando Magic?
Well, I was excited about that because I knew that in an expansion situation that everybody's equal. There's no all-stars. There's no set starting lineup. you know, everybody's coming in here to impress the coaching staff and earn a starting spot on opening night. And I was excited about that. Me being the player that I was a very confident player, like I said, in my abilities. When training camp started in Orlando, I was in the mind frame of, I don't care who is the small forwards here, they're going to have to battle me for the starting spot on opening night. I am going to be on the floor opening night.
Yep.
They will be calling Jerry Reynolds opening night for the Orlando Magic. And that was my goal. I fulfilled that goal. So I was very excited about that.
That's great to hear. Now, in three seasons with Orlando, you had the best individual numbers of your career. In about 25 minutes a game, you averaged almost 13 points to go along with four rebounds and almost three assists per game. You had a career high of 34 points along with seven boards and five assists in an April game against Indiana. Is that a particular game that you can recall, or what was the experience like playing at the arena in front of a crowd that just wanted to love their franchise and want to see them do so well?
Well, let's talk about the fans at Orlando. Until I got there, you know, the fans were always great in Milwaukee and in Seattle, but there was nothing like Orlando Magic atmosphere and the fans. Being an expansion team, there was a lot of excitement in the city of Orlando and the surrounding areas, and fans were just hyped to have basketball in Florida. So it was just a crazy, in a good way, experience from the fans. And for me, that's always been something that elevated my game more, was, you know, a great fan base. So opening night there for the first preseason game was just electric. You know, the fans were, they treated it like it was a championship game. You know, I think we won that first preseason game and the fans like lost their minds. It was crazy there that night. I really welcomed that whole Orlando situation with open arms.
Well, even though I am in Australia, watching games back from that era, from the early 90s that I've since either obtained on VHS or DVD or even just watching online through YouTube, you can tell that the crowd were completely into the game and they love to see their team do well, even though it was an expansion team just trying to get their start in the league. So definitely some great memories, even from me over here in Australia that I can recall. Now, this was something I had no idea about your career before we chatted. I hope you don't mind discussing it. In March of 1992, you were placed on the injured list. And from what I've read, there was a game in January against the New York Knicks and Patrick Ewing collected you with a forearm, I believe, to the top of the head or the back of your neck. And it began what would be a moment that would affect your career and just life in general for quite a few years following. Do you mind just expanding a little bit about what actually took place there and the effect that it had on you, because it clearly changed the trajectory of your career?
Well, yeah, I don't mind talking about it. It was a game in Orlando, a home game for us, and I had beat my man off the dribble, and I was going to the basket where Patrick Ewing lived around the basket. Being, you know, that's when big guys played inside in the paint. I didn't play in the era where all the big guys are at the three-point line shooting threes or defending three-point players outside.
Yeah.
So I go to the basket. I beat my man off the dribble, which I was known for. I could get five people pretty easily. So he came to help, and when I got to the basket, I pump-faked him. And when I pump-faked him, he went for the fake. And as he was coming down, I was going up to draw the contact. And his body, it wasn't his elbow, his body landed on my head.
Okay, wow.
My head kind of got under his body, and he snapped my head back with his body, with his 270-pound body coming on my neck. It felt like my neck snapped, but it wasn't broke. It was just what we thought was a sprain at first, because I shot the free throws, actually, and I had to be taken out the game after that. I actually stayed on the bench and didn't go to the locker room. But after the game, I did have x-rays done, and the x-rays came back negative. So we just treated it with the trainers as if it were a sprained neck.
Right.
A week goes by, you know, I'm still playing. I didn't get put on injury reserve, and I'm just trying to deal with the pain and stuff like that. So the pain got to be a little too much. And so they send me back to the doctor to get an MRI done. The MRI results came back and said I had two crushed discs in my neck. Well, it didn't require surgery. The doctor actually said, well, he said you have two choices. You could live with this pain and, you know, just go through your life living with this pain, or you can have surgery and the pain will be gone. So it was a no-brainer. I was like, I need this pain to be gone, because the pain was excruciating and it was affecting my sleep at night. I had a tingling feeling that was going down my arm. Like every other 2-3 minutes, I would have a tingling that was going down my arm. Wow. And that used to happen through the night when I was trying to sleep, and it really like bothered me. So it was a no-brainer to do the surgery. And I went to some of the best doctors, and the surgery was a success. And that's how that went. I had to stay away from the game for, I had 3-hour surgery where they took a piece of my hip bone and put it in where the discs were. And the surgery went good. I had to be in a neck brace for 6 weeks. So I had the surgery in April of 92. And then that same year in October training camp, I was back in training camp. And I think that looking back on it, I should have took that year off and then come back the next year after I healed properly. But the doctors had told me, you know, everything was good. You know, I cleared the physical. I did everything, you know, that I had to do therapy wise.
Yep.
And so I was cleared to play. You know, I made sure the doctors said, yeah. I said, could I go to training camp? And, you know, they said, yeah, if you feel strong, which I did. They say you can go to training camp. So I did. I went to training camp and everything was going okay. This was Shaq's rookie year. 92, the fall of 92 was Shaq's rookie year. So I was excited going into the year. You know, I had always desired to play with a dominant big man, a good big man, because on every team that I played for, we didn't have that dominant big man. Milwaukee, we didn't really have it. Even though we had Sigma my last year in Milwaukee, we got him at the end of his career, and he wasn't the Jack Sigma that won the championships in Seattle. He was the older Jack Sigma. He was still great, man.
Yeah.
And learned a lot from Jack. Jack was a great professional, a great player, but he wasn't that big man that I was longing to play with in the NBA. I was actually hoping that I got drafted to Houston because I wanted to play with Akeem Olajuwon so bad, you know?
Yeah.
Because I played him in college 1 year at the University of Houston as well. But, yeah, so when Shaq came into the Orlando picture, I was really excited about that. So I'm in training camp one day. Nobody's around me, so there was no contact. I was just running down the court, and I went to look over my shoulder, and I had this pain in my neck that just dropped me to the floor. The pain was so bad that I just crumbled, like if somebody, like if a person hit me, and I just crumbled and I was screaming. I remember just being on the ground, just I'm sure I freaked everybody out, but be taken out of there. I think the ambulance had to come take me in a stretcher, and I was in traction. I had to go to the hospital, and I was in traction for like 3 days. I think I had to sit in one position, and the doctors diagnosed me with a muscle spasm in that area. So basically, what it boils down to make a long story short is I think the doctors told me to go back too soon. Looking back, I wish I would have took that year off and let myself heal up properly and then go back the next year.
Well, I appreciate you explaining the behind the scenes there on that one. That would have been just terrible to try and deal with. And from what I've read, in January of 93, citing the recurring problems and issues with your neck, you announced your retirement from the NBA. How difficult was that decision at the time to actually say, okay, I have to retire? And then did you actually think you would play professionally again at all?
Well, no, I didn't. Actually, when I retired, it was funny because I was in the hospital. When I had went to the hospital to be in traction for those couple of days, when I was able to call, I called my agent. I think when I got there and got a little comfortable in this traction device they had me in, I asked him, could I use the phone? I called my agent because I had just signed a new contract the year before. with the Orlando Magic. I signed a 4-year, $6 million deal, which was the biggest deal of my career. I was actually in the prime of my career when that injury happened. Mm. So I was pretty miserable about that whole thing, but I was feeling good. Like I said, up until that muscle spasm, I was feeling really good in my comeback. But I called my agent. His name was Keith Glass. And I said, Keith, if I quit today, do I get all my money that I just signed for? Because I was concerned about my contract.
Yeah, understandable.
He said, Jerry, you get every dime. Your contract is guaranteed. So if you stop playing today, you will continue to get paid as if you were still playing. And I said, well, I'm not playing anymore. I was scared. I was really scared of the fact that nobody was around me. And I just had it really scared me into retire. Because, you know, it being a neck injury, I thought that, you know, the next thing might have been paralyzation, you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
I was really scared about that. So I actually told him that day that I wasn't going to play anymore because, you know, I didn't want that to ever happen again. So I actually retired that day, but I didn't make the announcement until whenever you said I said it, because I actually forgot when I made the announcement.
Yeah,
but I knew that I wasn't going to play anymore that day.
All right. Well, there you go. That's another little bit of insight there. And thanks again for elaborating. So at that stage, I guess you're thinking, will I ever actually play again or not? But you sat out the entire 93-94 season as well. And then from what I've read, you returned to the USBL, the United States Basketball League, playing for a team called the Atlanta Trojans in early 1995. And then you had some great stats there, over 25 points a game, 6 rebounds and about 7 assists. Also were named a USBL All-Star from what I've read too. So how did that sort of come to be? And then that would then lead to, I think, some LA Summer League play.
Right.
And then also briefly, you were in the CBA later that year, then earned a call back to the NBA to join the Milwaukee Bucks.
Yeah.
Which is a team you obviously began things with. So do you mind just talking about how that sort of came to be?
Yeah. Well, what happened was after my retirement got started, I totally got out of basketball because I didn't think I was going to play anymore.
Mm.
I was in the mind frame that basketball is done. So I had opened up a nightclub in Orlando called Heroes Nightclub. When I first got to Orlando, Heroes was called Mr. B's. It was like an old juke joint from the 50s or something like that. It was an old kind of rundown club that a lot of African Americans used to go there. So I used to go there because it was a fun little spot, even though it was just a hole in the wall spot. It was a fun little place.
Mm-hmm.
When I retired, I looked into purchasing Mr. B's, and I actually did. I bought the club and I totally gutted it out and started putting everything new in it. And I brought it up to a beautiful establishment, and I called it Heroes Nightclub. Totally not playing basketball. Now I'm a nightclub owner.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, opened that up in 92. So I retired in, that was in November of 92 is when I opened up Heroes. So I was doing that on a nightly basis and just doing the whole business thing. So like I said, I didn't pick up a basketball for 3 straight years. I didn't run. I didn't play basketball. I didn't lift weights. I didn't work out. I didn't do anything athletic. I'm now just a regular human being that's 6'8"
yeah.
And living in Orlando, Florida, running a business. After a couple of years had gone by, I always watched the games on TV, and I've been a fan of the game. So I'm watching the games, and my body now hasn't changed. You know, I call myself a freak of nature because my body still looks like if I could still play basketball, and I'm 54 years old now. So when I was like 32 at the time when I retired. So 3 years go by and I'm 35 now. So I'm looking at the games and then I took a shower one day and I look at my body and I see the same body that I had when I was playing 3 years ago. I knew that my skills hadn't left in my mind. Something made me look at myself in the mirror and say, man, you should give it a shot, man. You know, I know you miss it. I'm looking at myself and I'm like, I know you miss it. I'm like, yeah, I know I can still play, but So my neck started to feel like it never, I never had the problem before. You know, I lost a little bit of mobility as far as turning my neck all the way to one side or the other, but not much of the mobility did I lose. And I have no pain. I decided that I was going to make a comeback or try to come back and make it back to the NBA, which I knew a lot of people haven't done. I start working out in January of 1995. January 1995, I start working out. I moved up to Atlanta, Georgia, because I had a home in Atlanta. I had moved my mother from Brooklyn to Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay.
So I had a home there, and I went to Georgia. I took a good friend of mine, and we went up there to Atlanta to begin to work out and get ready for my comeback. So I started working out twice a day. I would lift weights and shoot in the morning, stretch. And then in the evening, I would play pickup. And I did that every day from January till the USBL started. I think the USBL started in, say, May.
Right.
May or June. So I had worked, did two a days for like 5-6 months. So I was in shape. Now I had added a jump shot to my game. You know, I'm 35 years old, and I start to finally know what it feels like to be a decent shooter. I wasn't a great shooter, but I was a pretty good shooter now.
Mm-hmm.
So with my skill set and a jump shot, now I was a little bit more dangerous because I was smarter. I still was athletic at 35. You know, I never had any knee injuries. My legs were still lively and springy. It was a smooth transition from no basketball at all to now going back into playing some minor league basketball, like you said, the USBL, coming off a 3-year break and averaging 25 points a game, some assists and some rebounds. And I, you know, probably did my steals and all of that. So I was feeling pretty good about the comeback at that point. Then from USBL, I went to the LA Summer League, which is a big thing where all the NBA people are. They got a chance to see me. I made the all-tournament team out there. I think I averaged about 25 points in the LA Summer League, too. And that kind of got the buzz going that I was coming back. The fall comes, and the CBA, which was equivalent to the D League now,
yep,
which was the NBA minor league, farm system kind of, sort of. So I go to the CBA and I play for Connecticut Pride. And my former teammate happened to be the head coach of the Connecticut Pride.
Paul McKesky.
Paul McKesky.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a good friend of mine, and playing for him was great. You know, it was easy. We knew each other. We respected each other. He let me be me, and, you know, we were pretty successful. But I only actually played 5 games in the CBA before I got the call from the NBA. So in 5 games, and I still have the certificate. I'm so proud of this certificate. In 5 games, I was selected, I think it was player of the month for the CBA. And I had a certificate that said I was shooting 53% from the 3-point line. And I had never been a shooter before in my life. And for 5 games, I was averaging 30 points a game, leading the CBA in scoring at 35 years old, and shooting 53% from 3-point line. So I was actually playing the best basketball of my life at that point. Because, like I said, I had a jump shot.
Yeah, that's great.
And my free throws, I was terrible at free throws from high school and in college. I was a 50-something percent at LSU for my career at LSU. And by the time I got to the CBA, I was shooting like 85% from the free throw line, along with 30 points a game. So my confidence level was high. I was a veteran. I was a grown man at the time. I had a lot of confidence in my ability. So when Milwaukee called, December 1st was when I got the call from Milwaukee Bucks. So I started the CBA in November, early November, and played a month and got called up by the NBA, which I was elated that, you know, my hard work had got me that phone call.
Mm.
So I was ready. I was ready. And Mike Dunleavy was the coach of the Bucks at the time of Milwaukee. And so Mike Dunleavy called me. He said, "Yeah, Jerry, I heard you tearing the CBA up, and You know, he's scoring a lot of points, and that's what we need. We need help scoring over here in Milwaukee. So I want to offer you a 10-day contract to come in and let us take a look at you and see what happens. I was like, well, you know, you need some scoring. I'm your guy, you know, because I'm feeling good right now. So we worked it out, and here I am in Milwaukee. I'm back in the NBA after a 3-year layoff and not playing basketball at all. Like I said, I didn't pick up a ball not one time in those 3 years.
It's remarkable. I can't believe that that was the process you went through from having to retire and then to actually, as you said, not touch a ball for years, and then to then fight your way back through USBL, the Summer League, CBA, and then getting that call up. So it's a fantastic story. How did it just feel to know what you accomplished in getting back into that league during the 95-96 season?
I was elated, man. I was just, you know, I kind of knew that I didn't lose my skills, that all I needed to do was get in the gym and polish them, because I knew I still had them. But like I said, that jump shot is, I knew what was missing from my arsenal. So I really worked on that, you know, in those mornings that I was shooting, I was really like getting a rhythm of what shooters do. It worked out fine. When I got to Milwaukee, it was almost like the Seattle thing where I was playing really, really well, you know. Doing when I get to Milwaukee, after he tells me this spiel about scoring, we need help scoring. You know, I know I'm not going to start, of course. I just, you know, I know I'm a veteran at the time. I know how to play. I know how to play basketball.
Mm-hmm.
The guys at Milwaukee, when I got back there, the two top guys were Glenn Big Dog Robinson and Ben Baker, who were two very good players. Glenn Robinson and I were the same position, so I would have been coming in for Glenn Robinson, playing the small forward position. But I think it was a political situation where they knew that if I came in and played well, it wouldn't look good for Glenn, who they had just, I think, gave $100 million to or something like that, some ridiculous contract. I guess they didn't want to make it look like I was might have even been better than him or anything like that. I don't know. I didn't play very much when I got to Milwaukee. And it was very frustrating because of the fact that I was playing the best basketball of my life at that time. And it's funny because as the season went on, Milwaukee signed me for the rest of the season. You know, when you go 1 10-day, they could send you back. Or, you know, if it didn't work out, they send you back. If they sign you for 2 10-days, then okay. But after 2 10-days, if they want to sign you, they have to sign you for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what happened with me. They signed me for the rest of the season. I think it was February, probably after the All-Star break. I went to Mike Dunleavy and I asked him to release me because I was so pissed off with not getting any playing time. And it's funny that I actually told this man, a head coach in the NBA, because I was a man at the time, 35 years old. You know, it's not a kid talking to a man. It's two men in the room. So I said, Mike, I thank you for bringing me here and giving me the opportunity. But I just want to be honest with you. I said, I'm a grown man. If I want to watch basketball, I could sit on my couch and drink a beer and watch basketball at home.
Yeah.
I don't need to sit here and watch basketball on this bench. And I told him, I said, I might be the first player in basketball history that wanted to go back to the CBA. I actually told a head coach in the NBA.
What was his reaction to that?
I don't really remember, but I think he said, Jerry, I understand. I understand. But, you know, it is what it is. And if you want me to release you, I'll release you. But he's basically telling me I'm not going to play very much. At that point in my career, I just wasn't in that frame of mind to sit and be a cheerleader on the bench. Looking back, I probably should have just sat there and been quiet and taken it, but I'm not built that way. I'm not a cheerleader. I'm a good teammate, but when I'm deserving of playing time, I should be playing. So that's where I was in my life at the time. So I asked him to release me. He did. The next year, I'm sure we'll get into my overseas career and So I didn't go back to the NBA that following year. I went to Cantu, Italy, played over there. 2 seasons in Italy.
Okay.
Back to back, yeah.
How was it to play the European style of game compared to what you'd known your whole life playing in the US?
It was different. It took some getting used to. I got called for a lot of travels over there that weren't travels over here,
but
over there, they call this. It's funny how they had to explain it to me that they said over here, like, say if I sweep through and put the ball on the ground, that if my foot touches the ground before the ball does, it's a trap.
Mm.
And I used to get called with that, like, once a game over there. Like, that wasn't a walk, dude. This is basketball. What are y'all talking about? Over here. Nah, nah, nah. So it took some getting used to. It was great. I loved the way they played over there. Just a little different with the funny shaped lane. They changed that now. Now that everybody uses the same square lanes now. But when I went over there, they had the funny shaped lane and played zone. And it was no zones being played in the NBA at that time. So it was just different. But it was fun, though. I had a lot of fun over there. And the food was great. I love Italian food, so you know. It was great.
Great experience. And so that's good on and off the court, I guess. We'll jump forward a little bit. You've been incredibly generous with your time. I've just realized we're not far off 2 hours. So I can't thank you enough for chatting with me for this period of time. What I would like to ask, though, in July of 2003, you were inducted into the Louisiana Basketball Hall of Fame. What are your memories of that day? And where would you sort of rank that achievement among all the others throughout your career?
Well, that was very special. Because I had a chance to receive an award, a Hall of Fame award of any stature is a great accomplishment. So I looked at it that way. It was just really special because my fiance, my son, my mom, and my nephew, we all drove from Atlanta, Georgia, over to Baton Rouge. They all got a chance to see the campus, and it was just a great trip. It was pretty emotional, too, because, you know, accepting something like an award like that in front of my mom and my fiance and my son and my nephew, it was just, it got me a little choked up and making my speech and stuff like that. But it was a great day, great honor to be selected in the Hall of Fame.
Incredible achievement. Pretty much the second last question I'd love to ask you. You recently talked about you're in the process of writing an autobiography at the moment. How's that sort of coming along, and what's the process been like thus far?
Oh, it's been great. My story is, like I said, it's a really unorthodox journey through basketball life. So I think that the book will be a great read because it'll touch on a lot of different things about my childhood and so on and so forth. From my mother actually saying to me when I grew up, she told me she didn't think I was going to live to be a man because I had asthma really bad as a kid.
All right. Okay.
And I used to have to go to the emergency room like twice a month. I would be in the emergency room with a bad asthma attack. She didn't really think that I was going to make it. It'll be very, very interesting. It's just a lot going on, and I'm hoping that the public will receive it pretty well.
I'm sure they will. If our chat today is anything to go by, it's going to be a fantastic read because you've just detailed some really unique experiences and, as you said, unorthodox ways that you've got to the highest level. So that's fantastic. Just one last thing. Basketball Digest has a regular feature which was called The Game I'll Never Forget. We've probably touched on it, but is there a particular game from your career that you can narrow down to be the one you'll never forget?
Oh man, the one I'll never forget. I think it would have to be that game that you chose to send me, that North Carolina college game.
Yeah.
I think that's going to have to trump my performance of 34 points against the Indiana Pacers, which we touched on a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That was my career high in the NBA, and that was my career high in college. So I think the career high in the NBA was against Reggie Miller or Michael Jordan. I'll take the Michael Jordan career high. That game was probably the most memorable game that I played in.
And it was a highlight-filled affair for sure. There was just incredible moves. So I do urge anybody listening to certainly check that out for sure. It's some great highlights. The only other thing I love to ask guests is, do you have any particular significance to the jersey number that you wore throughout your career? It was a majority of the time was number 35 at LSU and Milwaukee, Seattle, Orlando. Your second stint with the Bucks, I think you wore number 44.
Yeah.
What's the particular significance, if there is any, if you don't mind my asking?
Yeah, there's a little significance to both numbers.
Okay.
I wore number 20 in high school for no particular reason. But when I got to college, they were asking me which number I wanted to wear. And I thought about it. There was a guy by the name of Fly Williams, James Fly Williams, who was from my neighborhood, from Brownsville. He was like a basketball god in my community. He's a streetball legend, and if you Google him, you can find out a lot about him. Before Michael Jordan, and this is including Dr. J, Fly Williams was the best basketball player I had ever seen.
Wow.
Because he was 6'5". He did it all. He had great ball handling. He shot jump shots like Steph Curry at 6'5". He'd shoot bank shots from three-point range and call it out. He dunked on people. He just had the whole game. He wore 35 at Austin Peay University. He went to Austin Peay. He led the nation in scoring as a freshman, 29 points a game. I idolized him, and that's why I wore number 35.
That's fantastic.
When I came back, I wore 44.
Yeah.
And that was my tribute to the Iceman.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. I had opportunity to wear 44. I actually still have the 44 Milwaukee Bucks jersey here in my house, and I cherish it. So I got a 35 Magic jersey that I had at the 20th anniversary or the 25th anniversary. They gave us all a framed jersey, so I have that one here in my house. But
oh, that's great.
That's the significance about those two numbers.
Fantastic. Thank you for elaborating there. Jerry, it's been just fantastic to have this chance to speak with you for so long. Thank you for staying on the line.
I didn't even realize we've been at it for this long.
I can't thank you enough. Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me, and I'm excited to share the conversation with everybody, and all the best.
It's been great.
Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. You can suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. Leave a voicemail, simply visit inallanis.com/voice, click start recording, leave a message and press stop. You can even listen back before submitting. Press send and you're done. Time to share another great review from a fan of the show. Thanks to Bryce Cordham on the Australian iTunes store. His review is titled, "Here Comes Mr. Ryan is Right," which is fantastic. Obviously a nod of the head there to some classic NBA commentary. And it reads, "This podcast gives me goosebumps. I've been following this era of the NBA and MJ since my childhood. Adam's depth of knowledge is astounding. His guests are mesmerizing to listen to, and it takes you back to that magical time. I didn't think there was a bigger MJ fan in Australia than himself, but somehow, some way," again, another great little throwback there to some NBA commentary of yesteryear, "Adam takes it to another level with his passion." Referring to MJ, he says, "I know you'll get him on the show one day, mate, because limits, like fears, are often just an illusion." So great stuff there from Bryce. Thanks so much, mate, for your support. And a good little tip of the hat there as well to MJ's Hall of Fame induction there as well, how he signed off his speech to those in attendance. Worldwide, the show currently has 72 reviews. 69 of those are on iTunes and 3 on Stitcher. I have at least 3 more reviews to share in upcoming episodes too. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews, as I like to say, are definitely one of the best ways you can support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Your word-of-mouth recommendations are certainly worth their weight in gold. You can stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and much more. Simply visit inallanis.com/news. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. Apple Podcasts, visit inallanis.com/iTunes. Android, visit inallanis.com/Android. You can add it to your Stitcher playlist. inorlandis.com/stitcher. You can now subscribe also via Spotify, Pocket Casts, Player FM, TuneIn Radio, other podcatchers, and of course via the podcast app on your iOS device of choice. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show, and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallanis.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at inallanis. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/inallanis. Join me next time for another edition of the show. Hello, Jerry.
How you doing, Adam?
I'm good, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Ah, excellent. Great. Thanks again for agreeing to chat. I'm looking forward to talking about your career. How have you been?
I've been well. This is my first time Skyping.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, buddy.
Thank you. Had a lot of fun researching your career.
I request one thing, though.
Sure.
You got to take off that Bulls hat. Nah, I'm kidding. I'm giving you a hard time.